So I would like to talk a little bit about this Buddha nature idea. In its simplest version, the idea of a Buddha nature is kind of sometimes referred to as a seed. There's a seed within each of us of a Buddha nature, of having the nature of a Buddha. And that it's somehow some inherent purity, some inherent capacity for awakening that's in each person's being. And so practice is not about trying to attain something that we don't already have, but rather to let something we already have flower and manifest itself into our daily lives. And so you find in some of these Buddha nature schools, like Zen Buddhism, that a very important part of the practice is not the idea of attainment, but the idea of manifestation. That practice is about manifesting our innate purity, the innate qualities that of this so-called Buddha nature, of this awakened heart within us. And it might look like the same practice as other Buddhists, because it also entails dealing with what the obstructions, the hindrances, the attachments we have. But it isn't so much in order to get something that's not ours already, but rather to clear the dust away from the mirror so the mirror can shine purely, for example. And the idea is that the Buddha nature is not some simple, quiet, or boring kind of thing within us. But Buddha nature manifests itself in many different qualities, many different ways as we live our life. And it's a matter of finding how we manifest that in life, which is a big part of Zen practice. And that's a little bit different than Theravadan practice, where the rhetoric, at least, tends to be more on the side of attainment. You get something. And it's often done on retreat or in meditation, kind of solitary practice. And it's something that's kind of inward, kind of letting go, letting go. And the idea that you would actually then present it to the world, manifest it to the world, isn't talked about that much in their tradition. And I think that in our tradition, sometimes there's a kind of a way in which Theravadan practitioners shortchange themselves by being content with a certain level of realization or enlightenment that they might attain and feel, oh, that's good enough, that I have that. I had this wonderful experience, I've been changed somehow. But in Zen Buddhism, at least, the idea is that how you manifest it is maybe more important than how you realize it, how you attain it. Some Mahayana teachers will say things like, well, say, you know, attaining enlightenment is pretty easy. What's difficult is to express it, to live it in our lives, to manifest it in our lives. So we have teachers like Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, who says, when we practice the precept of not killing, we are watering the seed of the Buddha nature. So we're supporting it to grow, letting it grow and develop. Now, there's been a lot of controversy in Buddhism about whether or not the idea of a Buddha nature is really Buddhist, because it lends itself to idea of kind of a self in there. You know, like an Atman, like you have in some schools of Hinduism, or a soul. There's this thing in there which is, you know, your true self, and that's always there somehow, and you just have to tap into. It's innate in who we are. And it's a fair enough criticism, but the way the more nuanced teachers of the Buddha nature present it, Buddha nature itself is not a thing, but rather is a process. It's a form of process. And they very much go along with the early Buddhist idea that who we are as human being is a process. When there's nothing fixed about who we are. And our bodies, our minds, our hearts, our psyches, everything is always in process. It's always an activity and not a thing. And so in that it's an activity, our being is an activity, what are some of the underlying patterns or rules or manifestations of that activity? And so there are considered to be certain patterns or in certain kind of intelligence in the activity of a human being. And that intelligence takes different forms. So, for example, if you spend a lot of time lying, that there's a certain intelligence, a certain pattern that gets in motion by lying, where as we lie more and more, we tend to go kind of numb, getting contracted. It kind of makes us insensitive in a certain way to the world around us. As we speak more and more the truth, that has a different result on our psychophysical being. There's certain, some people would say, intelligence or certain patterns, certain rules that follow depending on how we live. So we can shape the process, the activity, who we are, get shaped by our intentions, by our behavior, by what we allow for. Now, the early Buddhist tradition that we're part of put a lot of emphasis on saying that this process, this activity of who we are, has nothing eternal, substantial, fixed in it. There's no soul or no eternal self or true self that's always there. Everything's always in flux and always moving. And so it's kind of a language of the negative, what's not there, what's not there. And you find the early tradition a lot of emphasis on what's absent, and also a lot of emphasis on eliminating and get rid of those things which tend to obstruct or contract the natural flow, the natural kind of movement of activity of this psychophysical being. Attachment, clinging, hate, fear are all activities that somehow interfere or block the natural activity that is a human being. As Buddhism developed in India, the idea of expressing Buddhist ideals in the negative became even bigger with the Mahayana idea of emptiness. When they said everything is empty, it's a matter of realizing the emptiness of all things. And not only are we empty of a self, but everything is empty. It's somehow in some inherent way. And it was a very powerful teaching in Buddhism, but it lent itself to people being discouraged. You know, what's the point of just everything's empty? It's kind of nihilism. It's kind of like a vacuum. You know, it's to realize this vacuum of everything, you know, and pull the rug away from everything. There's no place to stand, no place to be. And it's not very inspiring. Other people have, other religions have these great inspiring goals, like you can attain communion with God, and all his or her luminous glory. And, these poor Mahayanists, had to just, attain something called emptiness. It's not very appealing for some people. So as Buddhism developed in India, people started to introduce a positive description of what happens as people practice. And in a positive language, people can relate to it in more positive ways. And the early teachers of this kind of Buddha nature form then were very careful to maintain the teachings in a way that was true to the earlier tradition, but just kind of offered a little bit different package, a little bit different description. So they came up with the idea of a Buddha nature, that each of us has a seed. So the word garbha, which is sometimes translated as nature, also has a meaning of a womb, and also seems to have the meaning of a seed. So that it's both a seed or that can grow within us, but also a womb within us that nourishes and supports the growth of this embryonic Buddha that we all have. Now, this embryonic Buddha, this Buddha nature, is said to have a lot of different qualities. And so the idea of manifesting it or growing it or developing is a matter of developing or growing or manifesting the qualities of this Buddha nature. And there's many kind of qualities that are described. But some of the qualities, for example, are known as the 10 perfections. And there are different lists of which the 10 are. But the 10 are these beautiful qualities that as the Buddha nature grows, or as it has a chance to live or show itself or act through us, then it acts through us in one of these 10 forms. One form is a form of generosity. There's something innate about the Buddha nature within us that wants to manifest itself as generosity. When there's no obstacles, no fear, no contraction, and we really meet reality directly, then generosity is part of that expression of Buddha nature. There's something about that quality of Buddha nature that gets expressed as integrity, as ethical integrity. There's something that it wants to express itself in the form of letting go. Letting go of all the things, all the obstacles to its radiating forth or it manifesting or living itself. And that's a very important idea because there's something about this Buddha nature, it said, that wants to get born, wants to come out, wants to manifest itself. One way it's said in the tradition is that there's a kind of an innate movement towards awakening within each of us, that deep in our psyche, there's a very, very shy, perhaps at first, but it can become a very powerful momentum desire to realize our fullest potential of awakening or freedom. And so renunciation is this quality of this Buddha nature that gets out of the way for it realizing itself. So letting go of the things that are getting in the way. And then there's, I forget the order exactly of the list, but then it's letting go. And then there's wisdom. That somehow the ability to be wise or intelligent or discriminating, discerning about our experience, what's going on in reality, is also part of the Buddha nature. And this you'll see in a little while is a very important part of it all. And then there's the idea of strength. That there's something strong about Buddha nature. It wants to become strong. It wants to become some solid or substantial or really here in some kind of way. And the other one of the perfections is patience. It's like an internally patient or internally enduring. All kinds of things can happen. All kinds of uncomfortable things can happen to us. And the Buddha nature itself is just going to kind of stay open, stay relaxed about people complaining about us or criticizing us or unfortunate things happening or our computer breaking down or something. Buddha nature doesn't care about the computer. So then, and then there's the idea of truth. There's something about Buddha nature that manifests itself as truth. It wants to be true, is the manifestation of truth. Another quality of this kind of innate thing is loving kindness, to meeting the world with loving kindness. Another manifestation is equanimity, a form of love, a form of very balanced form of mind that's quite beautiful and radiant, called equanimity. Another form of manifestation, which is very important, which is not one of the 10 perfections, but infuses all of them, is the idea of compassion. That Buddha nature itself is innately compassionate in the appropriate circumstances. It expresses itself as compassion. So there's all these beautiful qualities are said to reside within each of us. And if we pay attention, then these can begin, we can begin nourishing them or supporting them, or they can begin shining through us. The early Buddhist tradition, the teachings of the Buddha, does not seem explicitly to have this kind of teaching. However, as I read the early sutras of the Buddha, it seems that the Buddha was kind of anti-metaphysical. He didn't want to kind of offer any kind of metaphysical teachings for the basis of what he had to offer. So the Buddha nature kind of idea lends itself to a certain kind of idea. It's kind of metaphysical teaching. Kind of, this is the true nature of who the human being is. Who knows if it is or isn't, right? So it's metaphysical. It's kind of like we can't really be sure. It just seems that way for some people, or they believe it's that way, or it seems to explain things really well that they seem to have experienced. The Buddha didn't like metaphysics. But with the teachings of the Buddha, it seems that certain things like compassion or kindness or ethics faith, many things, he just assumed were there. They're assumed. Compassion was assumed. Sympathy and empathy are assumed aspects of the human being. He didn't have any kind of philosophy or metaphysics explain why it was there. Just, that's the way human beings are. And then part of as a practice develops, these assumed qualities get stronger and stronger. And at some point, these qualities begin taking over. At some point, these qualities that are maybe assumed or kind of there or who knows where they come from get developed through practice, arise through practice, and they begin having a life of their own. And sometimes mindfulness, for example, can be seen as a quality of that arises within us, a strong sense of that begins kind of to have a snowballing effect. It gets stronger and stronger. It's almost like you can't get in the way of it anymore. You can't stop it. It's like going by itself. Sometimes the sense of interest or discovery or curiosity about life, investigation, seems to kind of have its own life and becomes very strong. And, you know, it's not like you doing it. It just like seems like interest, investigation is happening on its own. Sometimes there's a level of joy, different forms of joy, that bubbles up and is quite strong. And you can't really identify it as my joy. You can do it. People are so good at saying this is mine. But you can get, if you really relax, you see that it doesn't really belong to the normal world that we identify as myself. The ego, the one that is making choices or judging or analyzing or referring everything, defining everything as itself in a way. There's parts of who we are which is bigger than our self-definition. And our ego, our egotistical self, is actually a kind of contracted version of who we actually are. And a lot of aspects of who we are usually outside of our definition. And because of that, often outside of who we think we are, we don't even see it. So there's levels of joy that can bubble up and arise that are kind of not of the self in a sense, but they're definitely, it's happening to you. It's not happening to someone else. There's levels of happiness that kind of bubble up and can occur, where the whole body just shimmers or is soothed or is satisfied with a kind of deep level of happiness. There's levels of concentration. There's levels of equanimity. And these become stronger and stronger. It's so much so that for some people, they become close at hand. They might not be ever present, but they can be evoked. It's almost as if they become kind of our nature, a part of who we are, and then they can be evoked. So there are stories in the early tradition of some of these monks who got sick. And then the Buddha would go to visit them, and he would chant the seven factors of awakening. He would chant a list of some of these qualities that get developed through practice. And as he chanted those lists, they'd feel better and better until they got well. You know, somehow it evoked powerful healing qualities within us. When lay people got sick, then the Buddha or other people would go to them, and they wouldn't arouse the seven factors of awakening, because the assumption is lay people haven't practiced as deeply as monks back then. But rather, they would evoke their deep confidence and trust or faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. Again, qualities of deep faith within us that are accessible and can be evoked, and then somehow it moves through us in ways that I would suggest are bigger than our usual definition of self. So the early tradition assumes certain qualities get born. The later tradition wants to attribute these qualities to something we call the Buddha nature. It's a manifestation of this activity of our being. So I guess more interesting. And I'll say it this way, introduce it with this way. When Buddhism came to China, they had to somehow digest 1,000 years of Buddhist thought that had developed in India. And it was a huge undertaking. They were quite confused, the Chinese, when they first got Buddhism, because it was just so much to deal with. The Indians had dealt with it for 1,000 years. They knew it all, how it all fit together. But the Chinese got it all, kind of, in a sense. And it was one of the great intellectual endeavors of humankind, I think, was the Chinese attempt to try to make sense out of 1,000 years of Buddhism. And there were some great Chinese philosophers. And one of them, I think, was Sung Mi. Wrote a treatise about trying to make sense out of this. And then he summed up all of Buddhism in one sentence. So you can imagine, 1,000 years of Buddhist thought digested over several hundred years in China. And then this philosopher says, this is what it comes down to. And he said, awakening beckons us within everything. That's it. Awakening, liberation, is inviting us, is calling us, hey, come here, within everything. Within everything means everything. So you have these Zen teachers who like to say, things, they almost made statements like this, if you went to the bathroom, your poop was inviting you to, you're going to the bathroom, your shitting was inviting you. Your toilet paper, your dirty toilet paper was, right there you'll find your awakening, Everything, there's nothing which is outside. And that's a very important teaching, that one way to realize this Buddha nature, one way to realize awakening is not to turn away from anything, but rather to go directly into everything and to meet it directly and face it directly and go into it. By going into it, there's a possibility of freedom there, of enlightenment there. A lot of Buddhist practitioners actually will turn away from things. Well, I'm not going to deal with that because I'm going to develop my concentration and get really concentrated. And then once I get really concentrated, then, I can deal with it. And 2 weeks ago, I talked about the two, top-down to bottom-up kind of approach. If some of you are here, you remember. So the idea is you go into anything that arises or any aspect of who we are that arises. In that, we can somehow find our liberation, our freedom. So if we get angry, or if we're sad, or if we're delighted, or if whatever's going on, that in that experience, there's some way of relating to it, some way of entering it or becoming it, that can lead to your liberation, that can lead to discovering the Buddha nature within us, the Buddha seed. So how is that? Well, I think it's very akin to mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice is not clothed, Theravada mindfulness practice, in a great metaphysical teaching of Buddha nature and a seed within you, or within everything there is awakening and all that. It just says, pay attention to everything. Pay attention to everything very carefully. So one of the ways it works is if you pay attention to everything carefully, you develop certain qualities within you that are the qualities needed for liberation. So one of the qualities is truth. If you're really present and really see what's there for what it is, you're being truthful. So you see it directly. Another thing you develop is equanimity. If you're really there for it, you learn how to be present in a non-reactive way. If you're really present for something as it is, there's often an innate kind of curiosity or interest. What is this experience? And that's one of the factors of awakening. If you're really present for something and not holding yourself back, don't have aversion to it, not trying to hold on to it, but just really present there in a direct way, there's a kind of joy that can arise, a kind of happiness that can arise, a kind of tranquility that can, calm that can come into place. So in that kind of focus, by entering into everything, we develop certain subjective qualities in that truthful encounter. And as those qualities get developed, we become, the practice matures. And in the Mahayana tradition, they'd like to say that the qualities of awakening, the qualities of a Buddha, are beginning to manifest in us. In the Theravada tradition, they don't say that. They just say these qualities are developing. It's kind of like we're simpler, right? They're there. You don't have to say anything more. They're just there. And then they lead eventually to becoming fully awakened. But there's another way. Enlightenment beckons us within everything. It's not really saying that our subjective state will change as we're really truthfully present for what's going on. But somehow if we enter that experience, enter our experience more fully, there's something about entering that experience itself which leads to awakening, leads to freedom. So what is that? And I don't feel like I can expound on this with great authority in all kinds of possible ways. But I'll talk about it one way. And that is that, apologize for shifting gears a little bit. There are two forms of knowing that come into play with mindfulness practice. One form of knowing has to do with sensing our experience. And then the question is, where does sensing occur? So if you sense your hand right now, where does the sensing occur in your hand? Does it happen in your foot? Where does it happen? In your mind? Sensing happens in the mind?
That's where you experience it.
You experience it in your mind.
It's where you articulate it.
It's where you articulate it, but where's the sensing happening? Sorry?
In your body.
So one person says it in her body. Where's the sensing happening? She might be right. I mean, that's not going on because she's... But where is sensing happening?
In your hand.
That's even... Of course. So there's something about... Something happens... When you feel your hand, something happens in your hand that gives you those sensations, right? And I call that sensing. We're sensing the hand in the hand. The hand is having its own experience of the hand. Your foot is not experiencing your hand, but the hand is having its own experience of the hand. The mind can know what that experience is, but the hand is sensing itself. Vibration, tension, tingling, warmth, coolness. There's sensations happening right there in the hand. The hand is sensing itself. There's a kind of awareness that exists in the location of where we're experiencing it. Is that making some sense? Any of you confused at this point? Yes. No, you wouldn't. Your hand is a concept, but the sensing of it is still happening in that location, even though you can't put that concept around it, your eyes closed. In other words, let me say it this way. The sensing is happening in the place where the sensations are happening. The sensations are happening where the sensations happen, not anywhere else. Is that making some sense? So if your knee hurts, the pain in your knee, there's a kind of a sensing or knowing or that awareness of that that happens in the location where the pain is. So I think Bill's going to clarify.
No, help. What about people who have lost an arm or a leg or a sense it.
Yeah.
Because the neurons in the center of the brain that actually sees that are still being fired.
For the purposes of this talk, we don't have to go there. So there's a sensing that happens in the location where the experience is going on. Distinct from that is the knowing what that experience is. And that can be more or less precise than the knowing. You can feel, oh, I'm having, something's happening to me in my hand. I don't know what it is. You know, I've sat down on wet benches. And then something's happening down there in my butt. I'm not sure what it is yet. And then you, oh. And then you know after a while, oh, it's cold, it's damp, it's wet, you know. And then you look, it's, oh. So there's knowing that's distinct from the sensing. Part of what mindfulness practice involves is relaxing into the sensing of the experience and just allowing it to almost become the sensations of the experience. Bringing a kind of sense of presence or involvement, or you know, just allowing yourself to really take in that sensory experience. Whatever happens to us in life, whatever experience we're having, has an element of also being sensory. This awakening beckons us within everything is a suggestion, go in and dive in to the immediacy of how it's being sensed. That's a non-dual world. There's no duality between the experience and the sensation and the sensing of it. You have a sensation and there's a sensing right there, right? There's no sensation without sensing, even though you might not be paying attention to it. There's a kind of a sensing that goes on there. So part of Buddhist practice is to delve into this non-dualistic world, this undivided world, of how the sensing is happening in and of itself. Most of us hold ourselves distinct from it, apart from it. We judge it, we're measuring it, we're defining against this kind of self. But if we learn to relax and delve into this immediacy of life, then there's something in there that it said that this Buddha seed can begin to blossom and grow. One of the things it said is that as we enter into this non-dualistic world of sensing, and we're quite stable there and concentrated there, that the mind's capacity to know, to cognize what the experience is, oh, that's wet, you know, or that's pain in my knee. The cognizing aspect functions naturally. It's part of Buddha nature, innate part of human being, is to cognize things. It's not considered a bad or wrong thing. It's just what minds do. As we enter into the experience fully, this experience, kind of become that experience almost, as they say in Zen, then part of that experience is also that part of the mind that can cognize what that experience is. There's kind of clarity, and that the more fully we can enter the present moment, the greater clarity and precision actually the mind wants to do. Oh, this is what's going on. It might not be immediate, but as the mind gets more and more relaxed, a very relaxed mind cognizes, which is a function which is very closely akin to mindfulness practice. Now, as we begin sensing the world and feeling it and letting this kind of sensory mindfulness world arise, in and of itself, it becomes harder and harder to maintain some of the divisions we have between ourselves and the world. And much of our life is made up of divisions, of dividing the world up. The outer layer can be seen, kind of the Buddhist tradition, the outer layer of kind of division is somehow defining the self, myself, in relationship to other things. To what I'm not and to what I am. I am, I am a Dharma teacher. Thank you. That's who I am. To live, to be attached to that identity is to divide myself into something that I am. And if I hold on to that, that's a source of suffering. Define ourselves by our hair or our clothes or ethnicity. Or to define ourselves by our intelligence or lack of it, or our kindness or lack of it. To define ourselves as being a person who's in relationship to someone or not in relationship, or by our bank account. There's all these ways, you know, we measure ourselves and judge ourselves and hold ourselves. Some of them are kind of natural. I mean, I'm a Dharma teacher, that's my role. But to confuse a role with identity, or to grasp onto a role or identity, you know, I'm a man, usually. And so, I'm not going to deny that identity, but there's a way in which I can hold on to it which divides my world unnecessarily. If I hold on to it. It turns out that one of the most difficult, one of the first steps in practice we have to come to terms with is the ways in which we define ourselves in a particular way, and then narrow ourselves or constrict ourselves by that definition. And so part of the teaching of not self is to challenge us to look at how are we defining ourselves, how are we trying to represent ourselves, present ourselves to the world so the world sees us a certain way, thinks of us a certain way. How do we represent ourselves to ourselves so that, you know, I'm worthy, I'm not worthy, I'm full of shame, I'm this and that. And, you know, how do we define ourselves and then get stuck with that? That's one of the first things we need to deal with. As we enter into the immediacy of our experience, the non-dual world of our sensations, feeling it, it becomes harder and harder to maintain these ideas and clinging to a definition of who we are. So the next challenge in really entering into our experience fully and kind of finding liberation is dealing with our desires and our aversions, our desire for sensual pleasure and comfort and nice things, or our desire for aversion, or not desire, but our aversion, our hates, our ill will, our pushing things away. And as we enter the world of the immediacy of life, we have to somehow come to terms and deal with our tremendous tendency to want things, to desire, you know, pleasure and comfort. You might not want it anymore for your self-definition, but you just want to have this wonderful pleasure. It's really great. Or this, you know, you just want to push things away, you just get rid of them. And then as that gets kind of being settled and dealt with in practice, in order to go deeper, more fully into our experience, we have to also somehow deal with something very, very subtle, which the tradition calls a sense of I am-ness, that I am. And it can seem very innocent, very obvious that I'm not a doctor, I'm not this, I'm not that, you know, I'm not going to hold on to them, that is my identity. But, you know, I am. I think, therefore I am. I sense, therefore I am. I'm conscious, therefore I am. There is some kind of agent, some kind of being, some kind of emness here. Just a sense of presence, and that presence kind of vibrates. That presence kind of knows itself, and there's kind of a sense of emness. And people say, well, yeah, the emness, it just is. It's non-dual. Just like, there's no outside or inside, just a sense of emness. The Buddhist tradition says if you really want to enter this immediacy of life, enter into the experience fully, you have to also come to terms with this very subtle sense of emness and let that dissolve and fall away. And then that opens up into the world of awakening, of freedom. But it's a very strange freedom because very unsatisfying from the point of view of someone who wants things for themselves. Like, you want to be the most enlightened person on your block? That'd be great, wouldn't it? You can have your little badge, you know. We can give out diplomas and you can put it on your wall. You know, it'd be really great for the ego, right? But it doesn't, you know, you have to let go of that ego in order to get there. And so the ego, you know, so it doesn't do the ego any good. Or if you come out of that experience and your ego comes back, you look at it and say, gee, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. It's kind of like, I have this ego here, but if it wants certain things, but if I get enlightened, if I abide in the enlightened space or drop back to it, or it seems to like, you know, I have to let go of the ego enough. It's not going to do my ego any good because it's not there to enjoy it. So it's kind of like, you know, it's funny. But to enter into whatever is going on and begin going through the layers that's present within any experience at all, because those layers are there no matter what's happening. If we're very subtly bored with what's going on, well, that's not going to do me much good in practice. There's some kind of sense of self that's operating there. Some of these layers is operating there. And so to really enter the world of the direct experience, you have to kind of begin to, you know, deal with these things. So the luminous quality, or the liberated quality, or the immediacy, or the sense of kind of fullness or completion of this very moment begins to show itself and shine for us. So within everything, then, some Mahayana Buddhists will say, abides Buddha nature. Everything has Buddha nature. Not just we, human beings, have Buddha nature, but they'll go so far as to say that plants and trees and rocks, and if they were in California, you know, they would say asphalt, you know, probably, you know, and your steering wheel in your car, you know, everything has Buddha nature. And they're not saying, you know, so I don't know exactly what they mean, but it's like, my understanding is they mean, if you enter into the immediacy of this moment right here, as full as you can, and begin dropping these layers, then awakening and liberation is found right there. One of the manifestations of Buddha nature, as is described in tradition, later tradition, is that it wants truth. It's truthful. One of the perfections of the early tradition is truth. Awakening beckons us within everything is an invitation to be truthful about whatever is going on. So if you're feeling sad, if you're feeling self-conscious, if you're feeling angry, if you're feeling, whatever you're feeling, whatever's going on for us as an individual, no matter what, no matter how awful and ugly it is or how beautiful it is, there's a way of learning how to enter that and being very honest about it, impeccably honest. This is what's happening now. To be real and honest, this is what's going on now. And then to trust that if we're real and honest and true, what's happening right now, that that's a doorway into this deeper world, or fuller world, or more complete world, of what some people call the Buddha nature. The realization of Buddha nature, or the manifestation of Buddha nature. And as we enter into whatever's going on, even murderous rage, with a sense of practice of becoming it and being kind of very close to it, that innate in the intelligence or the patterning or the law of who we are, this Buddha nature, is we'll be ethical. We don't have to be afraid of ourselves if we enter into what's going on with tremendous truth and honesty and be there fully for it and kind of trace it back, kind of let it unfold and reveal itself what's going on. So at least in mindfulness practice, when we're sitting in meditation, even without the whole metaphysics of Buddha nature, what we're asked to do in mindfulness practice is to be uncompromisingly honest about what's happening right now. And then as we're uncompromisingly honest about what's happening right now, not hold ourselves at a distance from that, but in meditation, to enter the sense world, the immediacy of that experience. And as we enter the immediacy of that experience, then to let the deeper aspects of our attachments and contractions clarify themselves and unravel so that the luminous quality of awakening can begin to shine forth. Part of the last thing I'll say, I apologize for going on, the Buddha nature kind of metaphysics or theory also comes with it the idea that all the qualities of a Buddha are already within us. And there's something, in a sense, we already know or can access. There's some part of us that maybe intuits it or sense it or has had some experience in our life of having these different qualities appear. They're not strangers to us. And so by coming down and recognizing them, beginning to make space for them, they can grow. The recognition of our enlightened qualities strengthens them. Ignoring them kind of weakens them. So part of practice is to begin to recognize some of these beautiful qualities of who we are. So for example, the paramis, the paramitas. And since I started with a plug for Michael Zimmerman's class, I'll end with a plug for, if you want to come and explore these qualities, you can come to the Dharma practice days we're going to have over the next year, where we're going to explore these 10 different paramis that hopefully we all can have some deep experience of. So I hope that was interesting or useful to give that talk. I'm aware that it could be a little bit confusing to kind of go back and forth so quickly between different Buddhist traditions, and I apologize if that's the case. And if this talk didn't work, then at least remember the part that says about be honest about what's going on. And if you're honestly confused, your awakening is right there.